Welcome to the Asia Chessboard, the podcast that examines geopolitical dynamics in Asia and takes an inside look at the making of grand strategy. I'm Andrew Schwartz at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Linchpin of ASEAN and sitting astride some of the globe's most important sea lines of communication, Indonesia is a critical part of the Asia chessboard. Mike is joined by former Indonesian ambassador to the U.S., Dr. Dino Jalal, to discuss Indonesia's strategic culture and relationship with the United States.
Welcome back to the Asia chessboard. I'm Michael Green, and I'm joined today by a good friend, Pak Dino Jalal, one of the most important thinkers on Indonesian foreign policy strategy and Asia and the United States in this entire region. We're here in Sydney, Australia for a conference, and Dino agreed to meet with me. We're going to talk about Indonesia, the world's third largest democracy, largest Islamic state, at a geopolitical crossroads in the Indo-Pacific, on the front line of every issue that matters to the United States and its allies. And no one is better positioned to help us understand it than Dino Jalal. So Dino, let's start by talking about you. You got into this business because your dad was a diplomat, right?
Yes, my father, Professor Hasim Jalal, was a law of the sea diplomat who spent like four decades working on law of the sea issues, including the UN Convention on Law of the Sea.
He was posted overseas. You grew up overseas, so?
Overseas, including in New York and Washington, D.C., when my dad was posted there. So it's nice for me to come back to Washington, D.C. At the Indonesian embassy.
Well, you were ambassador.
Well, I was ambassador, yeah.
And you were a very good ambassador, and our kids are about the same age. And I remember when my son did play dates at the residence, how difficult to explain to him why I didn't have a similar setup for play dates with his friends, but it was great fun. You served there in the embassy in the 2000s when I was in the White House during the Bush administration. You were also, is National Security Advisor the right title with President?
Foreign Policy Advisor.
Foreign Policy Advisor to President SBY. But did you join the Foreign Office, the diplomatic service, right after college?
Yes, I joined in 1987.
And what did you study in college? How did you
I studied international relations always for my undergrad, my graduate, and also for my PhD.
And you knew you wanted to be a diplomat from an early age?
Yeah, I've always, that's what I always wanted to do, and I couldn't imagine doing anything else. Yeah.
So, and now you're running a think tank, but it's a very unique kind of think tank. Tell us about it.
Well, it's the largest foreign policy group in Indonesia. It's called Foreign Policy Community of Indonesia. We are more a cause group where we try to engage the grassroots about global issues because there's still some pockets of xenophobia in Indonesia. And it's very important for our group to tell the public that nationalism alone is not enough. You got to combine nationalism with internationalism. And that's how you get a healthy mix of getting the country to the next level.
As I understand it, you have almost like rock concerts with bands and music and then people talking about foreign policy with thousands of people.
Yes, yeah. I'm quite proud of that because we convene what we think is the largest foreign policy conference in the world.
How many
the last
people?
One, 11,000 last one.
Yeah, it's a little more than CSIS or Brookings.
yeah. And people come in, they line up, like they go to a rock concert, they line up starting at like 7 or 8 o'clock and they stay all the way until the end. And gives me hope because it reaffirms that young people are actually interested on global issues. It's just a question of how you package foreign policy to them and how you communicate with them. Sometimes we use too much multilateral, bureaucratic, technocratic language and jargons, and that didn't go well with them. But once we start using a different set of language and a way of packaging issues to them, they come in droves.
Now, is this primarily in Jakarta or are you
only in Jakarta?
Country? Only in Jakarta.
Yeah. The annual conference is in Jakarta, but occasionally we do events outside Jakarta as well.
Great. Tell us, how would you describe the strategic culture of Indonesia? You've seen it from your dad's time to your own time in the Foreign Office. A lot of change.
Yes.
But some fundamentals, non-alignment and things like that. Mm-hmm. How would you describe the strategic culture of Indonesia, how it's changed in your career?
Well, first, the desire to be independent has always been central to the way we see our role in the world. So this reflected in the Asia-Africa conference, in non-aligned movement,
which
in
started
ASEAN
in Bandung in 1955.
Yes.
And confounded the Eisenhower administration. They didn't know what to do with this.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I think someone said that to be neutral is to be, what is it?
Not on our side. You're with us or you're against us.
To be immoral or something like that.
From time to time, U.S. foreign policy slips into that. But the Bandung conference included Japan
yes.
and other countries that were allies with the U.S.
Yes. So the desire to be independent and to make our own mind up when we make a strategic move, that has stayed until now. So that's why the doctrine that has remained is the independent and active doctrine. Others come and go, you know, the ecumenical diplomacy, this and that, you know. But the one that has stayed through generations since we became independent is the independent and active doctrine, yeah.
There was a brief period in 1964 and 5 when Sukarno declared the Jakarta, Pyongyang, Beijing, Phnom Penh, Hanoi axis, which was a kind of alliance of socialist communist states during the Cold War, and then he was overthrown in a coup. Other than that one case, Indonesia has never sought allies.
Yes, yeah, that was seen as a deviation, and that was the time also that we pulled out of the United Nations, right? Yeah. And was seen too much closer to those sites, the Beijing, Pyongyang, Hanoi axis. So that was the exception, but overall, desire to be independent. And also in our strategic culture, we cannot allow any alliances, military alliances. Military cooperation, yes, but no alliances and no military base in Indonesia. So that remains until today. And another aspect is some kind of complex in dealing with major powers, right? Perhaps because we are middle powers, and then there was this historical upbringing that, you know, we were colonized for centuries. So whenever we dealt with the United States, right, or China, this complex about dealing with great power is always there. You know, there's a need to have some distance and some caution that we don't have when we deal with fellow major powers or smaller powers.
Indonesia's in MICTA, right?
MICTA, yes.
Mexico, Indonesia, Korea, Turkey, and
Australia.
So this middle power identity, is it important for Indonesian foreign policy?
It is important because it gives us a sense of placement and role.
But not alliance?
Not alliance, no.
Yeah.
No. And even then, Mike, I think all middle powers have not found a format yet, institutionally speaking.
Right.
Right. There's no real convergence of interest the way Western powers' interests converge. Right. So in that sense, Indonesia is still grappling with it. But the instinct now is to go with fellow middle powers whenever there is a global issue to be tackled, which means to go to Korea, either bilaterally or in a larger context, to Australia. We have very close relations.
But in a sense, Indonesia is not like Mexico or Turkey or Korea, because in the immediate neighborhood you live in, you are the big power.
I mean,
Indonesia could be the hegemonic power of Southeast Asia. And a lot of people in Washington, Canberra, and Tokyo would actually kind of like to see Indonesia have that kind of ambition. Is that also something that's too complicated, or do people in Jakarta start thinking in those terms?
Well, there are two instincts at work when it comes to Southeast Asia. The first instinct is to lead Southeast Asia, because we always say we're the largest country there, largest population, largest area, and largest economy, and so on. But at the same time, we know if we lead Southeast Asia too much out in the front, then that will be problematic, right? So this is why we always say the concept of equality is critical to our leadership in the region, which means we may be much bigger than Singapore or Timor-Leste, right? But when we talk to them, we are as equal with Brunei and so on, right? And that has been a principle that was upheld by Suharto.
Yeah.
And this is, I remember reading Lee Kuan Yew's memoir, and he stated that this was his main strategic ambition when dealing with Suharto, securing this principle or notion of equality between Indonesia and Singapore. So that's what we wanted to do. We want to lead, but also we want humbly to be the equal of all Southeast Asian nations.
So ASEAN centrality, the idea that multilateral diplomacy in Asia architecture should be centered on ASEAN and therefore on the consensus-based approach of the 10 member states, that's the talking point for every member of ASEAN. But how seriously do people in Jakarta take ASEAN? I mean, I get different vibes. ASEAN is a critical part of this, you know, equal view of neighboring states that you described. It's consistent with non-alignment. But Indonesia is the biggest country in ASEAN. And sometimes I get the feeling, reading Indonesian scholars, that they feel a little bit constrained by ASEAN, ready to move beyond it. What's the thinking about ASEAN?
Indonesia and ASEAN really depends on who the president is, right? So when I served President SBY, he was very determined that Indonesia should be a leader in ASEAN. So a lot of initiatives came from Indonesia. Mm-hmm. President Jokowi is a different kind of president. You know, he was not a foreign policy president, as he admits himself, right? He had a different way of functioning within ASEAN compared to President SBY. But still, Indonesia, the present foreign minister talks a lot about collective leadership, mm-hmm. for example, right? And a lot of ASEAN still expect Indonesia to lead.
Was it good politics for SBY to convey that kind of ambition in domestic politics, or is it purely his own vision?
Well, he wanted Indonesia to become a regional power and global player, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, he thought that that was a responsibility for Indonesia, a duty for Indonesia.
Yeah. And that's not true with the current Jokowi government in the same way?
Yeah, no, the priorities are different. You know, President Jokowi, in some ways, are similar to other countries, including United States, where the priority is more domestic.
Yeah.
He doesn't call it Indonesia first, but still, right, you know, right. Everything is about domestic considerations. He's the man in a hurry to fulfill his election promises, which is mostly economic.
Right. And very big.
Yes.
Very big, ambitious promises where he's making only limited progress, I think, most international observers would say, but with a second term and a chance to try to do more.
And I would add that I do think Indonesia should always pursue an ASEAN-first foreign policy, mm-hmm. in response to your question. I know that there are people who say, you know, let's go to G20, you know, that should be our priority, and so on and so on. But, you know, G20 has limitations.
Yeah.
And what makes Indonesia relevant elsewhere is our ability to say, not just Indonesia is number fourth in population in the world and so on, but the fact that if you want to engage Southeast Asia, you have to engage Indonesia,
right,
primarily, yeah, as the largest country and so on, right? So ASEAN first strategy adds to our strategic importance, mm-hmm. to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And whoever is in power, they should play that card.
Indonesia doesn't have formal allies, but you have friends. Mm-hmm. And the relations with big powers and neighboring countries have changed. Mm-hmm. For example, Australia relations are pretty good right now compared to, mm-hmm. 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. Who are Indonesia's friends? Japan's another one where I think relations have really improved. And for your president, for SBY, that was a real priority. How would you characterize the countries where friendship has kind of increased in recent years, and then countries where it's become a little more complicated?
The closest, definitely China. No doubt about it. And especially in the last 5 years.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Closest in what sense?
Closest economically. Indonesia now trades with China almost 3 times more than we do with the United States. Chinese tourists to Indonesia is more than Japanese, American, and Australian and Russian tourists combined. Mm-hmm. And China.
But Chinese PLA ships and Coast Guard ships are
exactly
entering,
yeah,
your,
yes,
claimed waters, dwelling near your oil exploration. And there is, of course, a history of anti-Chinese pogroms, really, going back to the 60s and 70s in Indonesia.
Yeah.
So are you describing the people's feeling towards China?
No, I'm saying the most impactful country now to Indonesia. Yeah, in economic terms, yeah.
Okay, how about friendship and trust?
Now, that remains a work in progress,
yeah,
especially with what happened in Natuna recently.
Yeah.
There is a lot of thinking and rebalancing being thought of in Jakarta.
Yeah, I was in Jakarta 2 months ago,
yeah,
and saw some senior level people and heard a lot about Natuna, and the Chinese ships were being reinforced and supplied from the artificial islands in the South China Sea that, yeah, they built. And there was a real concern that this might be the new normal. Mm. Japan?
One quick point on China. Indonesians find it very weird that a country that we studied in the north, in the book, to be situated way, way up north, now is actually a next door neighbor because of what they claim to be, you know, Nine Dash Line and North Natuna Sea are overlapping and so on. So that explains the anger in Indonesia. And the Chinese, you know, Beijing should understand it. What if Indonesia was claiming waters off Hainan, for example? You know, the Chinese people, right, are nuts, right? So that's the mood in Indonesia in the last few weeks was like that. You know, people are like, seriously, you know, the Chinese are claiming our waters? There's a disbelief about that.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to see a little bit, a lot of rebalancing being done from Jakarta.
Without going to form alliances. But who are the countries Indonesia might rebalance towards?
Obviously, the United States. In the last 5 years, President Jokowi has not visited the White House. I think if you look at all Southeast Asian leaders, probably only Jokowi and Duterte.
Duterte.
And President Trump has not visited Indonesia. You know, I think you'll see some changes in efforts at some diplomatic bilateral visits.
Primarily to signal Beijing.
Yes.
And does Japan or Australia, do they play, or India,
yes.
do they play?
Well, in Indonesia, if you ask me what is the most intense rivalry, it's not the US-China.
Right.
It's China-Japan.
Interesting.
Right. And, you know, we saw this in the railway, Jakarta-Bandung, yeah. right, and so on.
Where the Japanese were proposing a bullet train, the Chinese were proposing a bullet train. Chinese, did they win? It's not clear to me.
They won now. Jakarta-Bandung is, they say by next year it'll be completed, or so 22 or 21, yeah. But the Japanese are getting the longer one now, the Jakarta-Surabaya.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and so on. There's a lot of efforts to woo Japanese investments in Indonesia. And Indonesia welcomes the shift in Japan's defense portfolio.
Yeah, I remember when you were working for President SBY, he welcomed Prime Minister Abe's change in the interpretation of the Constitution to allow collective defense. Quite a change from when the Japanese Prime Minister Tanaka visited Indonesia in the early 70s and his motorcade was stoned.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Also, yeah. Australia. Much
Australia is very close. The closest Western nation to Indonesia now is Australia.
Not just geographically, but you mean in terms of the feelings of people?
Yeah, because I think Australians, they have a lot of officials who go to Indonesia, who understand Indonesia, who deal with Indonesia, right? You know, whereas in the United States now, if you look at the administration, I think you're going to have a hard time finding somebody who knows Indonesia from, you know, long-term experience and so on. And the will in Canberra towards Indonesia and strategic imperatives is much stronger to have close relations with Indonesia. I mean, that's why Jokowi is coming here and speaking at the parliament in a few days.
Here in Australia, where we are. I think part of that must have been Australian policy changes, too.
Mm-hmm.
25, 30 years ago, Australian defense policy was primarily focused on Indonesia. For Americans and for Washington, what's the most ambitious the U.S. should be for U.S.-Indonesia relations? It's not going to be an ally like Japan or Australia, obviously. It's probably not going to be a strategic partnership like India. Or could it? How far could the relationship go? And what does the U.S. have to do to get Indonesia right? What do we have to do to get our policy right on Indonesia?
Well, first, we already have a good strategic and comprehensive partnership, Indonesia and U.S. So the framework is there, right? But what is important within that framework is the institutional relationships. How often is the State Department or Pentagon talk to their counterparts in Indonesia? At what level? And is there strategic trust that should be re-earned, right? The strategic trust was there. Remember when I was in Washington, you were there, you know, we talk all the time and, you know, we had a good team on both sides and we talk about global issues together and we talk on the same length, right? You know, Mike, these kind of things have to be re-earned. Every administration, they have to redo it. Otherwise, you know...
And this administration has to earn it. And Jokowi's administration also, I guess, has to earn it. Yes, each side has to do its part.
Both sides, yes, yeah. The policy gap in the last 2 years or so, the Jokowi's intention to win the second term, and especially win the Islamic votes, that kept him away from Washington. Because when President Trump moved the embassy to Jerusalem, that became a grassroots issue.
That was a big problem for our relationship.
Yes. Yeah. 1 million people on the streets. And then all the Islamic groups are saying, look, if you move closer on this, or you support the U.S. move on this, then you're going to pay electorally. Yeah. For 2 years, and especially during campaign, Jokowi kept Washington at an arm's length. He would never be seen embracing and hugging President
Trump. I wonder if the Trump administration even considered the impact this move would have on what they say is their most important strategic challenge, the rise of China and relations with countries like Indonesia or Malaysia. So, but we were in the timeout chair. Now we have an opportunity to rebuild that trust.
Yeah, but okay, I'll be honest with you.
Please.
There is a fear as Indonesia looks at Washington. Look, maybe it's best for us to be at an arm's length because if you get closer, you get clobbered with tariffs, with taking away the economic incentives that were within the relationship.
Is this particular to the Trump administration?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. So there is that concern. And White House needs to send the signal, look, let's get closer and you don't need to worry about it. There's no, negative consequence of getting closer. But Washington should look at what China has done in the last 10, 20 years or so and ask, how can we be as impactful to Indonesia as China has been or is doing now here?
In the Bush administration, you mentioned you were in Washington. Karen Brooks was there, leading Indonesia expert in the White House, Bob Zelik, yes. at USTR, and then Deputy Secretary of State. The Obama administration, the Indonesia desk officer was President Obama.
Yeah.
Do you think people in Jakarta know who their go-to guy is in the Trump administration? Is there somebody who...
No. In the White House, so we hardly have a connection there.
Yeah.
In the State Department, the position has been vacant for quite some time, you know, and so on. As I said earlier, there's hardly a strong Asia hand at the relevant level in Pentagon and State Department. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but there seems to be a perception, at least compared to...
it's a mathematical fact that Trump administration has been very slow to mm-hmm. get people into these jobs, and they've had trouble keeping them in the jobs.
And on top of that, America first.
It's just too unpredictable, and people are afraid of getting burned.
We just not used to the message America first,
yeah.
because we see America throughout historical periods as a giver.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's a bit hard to digest America first, and then America wants to play leadership in the region. Right. So how do you square these two tendencies?
And then there's the question of how the U.S. or more partnership with us can help Indonesia with the security challenges people worry about. So there's a geopolitical concern about China, you mentioned, and the U.S. relationship and Japan and Australia can be important to that. For that, are people still worried about terrorism? I was struck when I was in Jakarta how much people talked about concerns about fighters returning from Syria. The new cabinet put a military man in charge of religious affairs for the first time. Is, you know, to be also candid with you, and you knew this, after 9/11, we were very worried about Indonesia
mm-hmm.
and terrorism. Maybe too worried,
mm-hmm.
but very worried.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of receded. But my sense is maybe there's concern now in Jakarta about returning fighters and extremism and terror.
Yeah, we had quite a few people fighting in ISIS, mm-hmm. and many of them have returned, and the government is keeping a close watch on them. They cannot be arrested due to our law and so on. What we see is new trends in terrorism in Indonesia. The last one being a suicide family bomber who bombed two churches in Surabaya.
Yeah.
And this also reflects a trend whereby instead of attacking a mall and shooting at everybody or bombing everybody, they shoot at members of a particular religion
mm-hmm.
who are praying in their house of worship. And, you know, we saw this same trend in New Zealand where Muslims were shot in mosques, and then in Sri Lanka as well, Christians were shot or bombed in churches. So we're seeing mutated terrorist cells and someone attacking non-Muslims in their house of worship. But what is also of concern is the way terrorists are recruited now. Before, it took some time, like 2 years
mm-hmm.
before you get baptized, so to speak. Now you can do it online, and it can happen within less than a month. And before, you had to go to military training and jungle and so on. And now you don't have to do it anymore. So there's a lot of new transformations of how the terrorists are adapting themselves.
So Indonesia is the third largest democracy in the world,
mm-hmm.
has hosted the Bali Democracy Forum,
mm-hmm.
but has this tension between that identity and non-alignment. How important is democracy to Indonesia's foreign policy identity?
Okay, this is an interesting question because, for the U.S., promoting democracy is part of your values that you want to
Although
spread.
Although now we say supporting democracy.
Supporting
to
democracy.
To be a little more modest.
Yes. India, I hope my friends in India, forgive me for saying that. India, I think, have an approach whereby, okay, democracy is ours, but we are very careful about exporting democracies mm-hmm. to other countries, right? I think Indonesia is halfway between the U.S. And, uh-huh. and India. We want to promote democratic values, but we are very careful about doing it. I think Myanmar is a good case.
Yeah.
We pushed for democracy, but the methodology was through private correspondence between President SBY and Senior General Tan Sui at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I knew because I was handling the
interesting. So it's quiet, face yeah. matters.
Yes.
But it's there.
It's there, and we push. We say, this is what you need to do, but we don't do it for the gallery. We don't go public with it either.
Right. Well, look, Pak Dino Jalal, you are a great asset for your country and for Indonesia's relationship with the U.S. and for the many thousands of young Indonesians who are learning about foreign policy in the world. I'm a little jealous. I don't know if I could get a couple thousand people at Georgetown to my class, even if I had a rock band. keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thanks for helping us figure out Indonesia's role on the chessboard.
Thank you, Mike. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. For more on strategy and the Asia program's work, visit the CSIS website at csis.org and click on the Asia program page.